I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes
and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life.
Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects.
Even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing.
Heyo, everybody. Welcome. Oh, there's the applause.
There's the applause.
They were stunned. They were stunned silent for a moment. So welcome, darling. We have a super cool guest today, Joe Hill.
I'm
not going to keep him waiting, but we will.
I'm so stoked.
I know.
Keep him waiting for very
long. We won't. Not very long, but you know how we do. If you're a faithful listener to the podcast, at the very beginning, we like to talk a little bit about, you know, what's going on. Such a celebration. Good to be back. We just did a best of life writing last week, which was actually, I think, very topical for authors who want to learn how to have a hand in their own adaptations, you know. So check that out if you missed it. Victor LaValle talked about it. And as you may know, he has The Changeling now on Apple TV Plus. And yeah, he's really out there pioneering. So that's what we did last week. What are you working on, darling?
Oh, God, I'm finishing up the Mace Windu novel, the Star Wars novel. I'm going through using Speechify to read the manuscript to me in Barack Obama's voice, which is great fun. I mean, I already had Snoop Dogg reading it to me.
That Snoop voice does not work for me. I'm sorry. I just, no.
No, it's like, you know, hey, D-O-double-G. Here's my lightsaber. You know, there's a limit to how far I can go with that.
But yeah.
Getting a sense of the flow, you know, just like that word pops out. That you know, that the, you know, it, the whole thing is that, that music is what happens between the notes, and poetry is what happens between the words. The same thing is true of the poetics of language in a story. You know, it, cinematically, you know, you have that kind of Eisensteinian montage thing where you take one image and collide it with another image to create a sense of emotional violence. In books, you have that, you know, it's Chip Delaney was talking about the transderivational search. Oh, that wasn't the word he used. That's from a different discipline. But it's that each word, your reader has to go into their mind to find the definition of the word. And then you have the next word, and they have to do the same thing. So what the writer is doing in some ways is choreographing where the reader's mind goes by leading them with words, with images, with phrases, callbacks to previous works, other works of art or other aspects of life. So you're not just looking at the denotative meaning of a sentence. You're asking yourself, what does the reader have to do to parse this sentence? And in my mind, the best way to do that is to listen to it. Because wow. We learn to listen to stories before we learn to read stories, let alone write stories.
Okay? First of all, I'm glad you started using words I knew. So thank you for that. And also, I'm a huge audio reader. So I 100% agree with you. I love audio. I love being in that child state of having a story yes. read to me, you know. So that's always fun.
You go into that once upon a time place. And it's really good. So, you know, going through the manuscript. A little frightening because, you know, whenever I get notes back from an editor, there's one part of my stomach that feels like I've gotten kicked by a horse.
It's the worst. You know,
it feels bad. Yeah. So I like to read over it with a little distance from it. And then the first time I go through it, I just do the low-hanging fruit. What are the easiest edits to make, which gives me time to ease past that sick feeling in my stomach and start seeing, oh, this is just a body of work that needs to be done.
Well, so that's great.
That's fun. Go for it.
I am working on the first draft of our plague short story, which is due April 1st. So it's about that time, you know, to give it room to breathe as the protagonists come to life. Surprise, surprise, they're children. You know, what a shock. And also I'm finishing the last revisions on a couple of indie comics, one of which is for a Shook anthology that we crowdfunded featuring Black women creators. Another one is a take on a werewolf story. So just doing some shorter works.
Is that our werewolf story?
Our werewolf. No, yeah. My werewolf story. Ours is the vampire story.
Okay, that's right, vampire.
And I want to get these short works off my plate completely before I start diving into my next novel, which I tentatively call Bear Creek Lodge, but it hasn't been announced really yet. So I can't wait to talk more about what's happening with that. But you know what? We do have a great guest.
Yes.
I'm feeling like, let's bring on our guests, right?
Yes, so, absolutely.
Joe Hill is the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Fireman, Heart-Shaped Box, and Strange Weather, which I'm reading right now, Strange Weather. Much of his work has been adapted for film and television. His second novel, Horns, was made into a cult horror comedy starring Daniel Radcliffe. His third novel, Nosferatu, was adapted for television by AMC. Love that series. And his short story, The Black Phone, was adapted for the big screen. Also, I love that.
That was really good.
So good. Lock and Key is his long-running comic book, also adapted. There's so much here in this bio. I can
an
go
embarrassment
on.
Of riches.
It's an embarrassment of riches. But let's just bring on New York Times bestseller, Joe Hill.
Hey guys.
All that fanfare.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me on. I wanted to open up by saying I know most people are listening to this, but some people might get to see video clips. And I want to establish that's not a sex swing in the back of my office. I've been looking at it. I've just been looking at it the last minute thinking, huh, that's a pull-up bar.
Yes, pull-up bar. I've got one in my office.
He has the identical one.
Swing, the sex
it's
swing
almost
is
exactly
over on
the same.
Corner.
Okay, the sex swing is in the other corner, he says. So. Which is also
let me ask you a question, because we do talk a lot about process here. Do you break up your writing time? In other words, do you go over there and do some pull-ups and some of this, like, you know, every hour on the hour sort of thing, or do you just from time to time?
Do I don't know that I I don't break up. I certainly don't break up my writing time to exercise. You know, I try to make time to work out after the kids go to bed, you know, three times a week, but I'm pitiful at it. You know, I'm a tea drinker. And, you know, the great thing about needing to make tea is it takes about 10 minutes, you know, to go down and boil the water and get it just right. And usually that's enough time to clear the mechanism.
Right.
And, you know, come back relatively refreshed.
About how often do you need to take breaks to stay sharp?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends on how it's going. When it's more frequently when I'm feeling defeated. You know, if I'm sitting there feeling like this is hard.
It's typing. Sometimes when, for me, the hardest part of writing is when it just feels like typing.
Yeah. If I can't push my way into the story, and so I'm just lining up sentences, and I can't get the sound right, and, you know, and then you start to, you start to overthink things. Have I spent too long on this moment? You know, is the story moving fast enough? Do we even need this scene? Did we even need the last scene? Do we even need this book?
Do we need this character? Yes.
Do we, you know?
Yeah. So. Oh, we've all been there. You know, Joe, I was trying to rack my brain over how we first connected. I hope I didn't cut you off in the middle of a sentence.
No, not at all.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, great. Okay.
How did we first connect? I don't remember anymore.
I think now I know. I finally figured it out. In 2020, during the initial COVID lockdown, I was a virtual moderator for a showrunners panel. And I met the showrunner of Nosferatu, and
Brian.
She was the one who connected us, right? So, yeah, Steve and I had my book, The Between, in development at AMC at the time. And I was like, how did I meet Joe over email? But now I just want to thank you sort of in person for how you supported my books last year with your blurbs for The Wishing Pool.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reformatory was my... Thank you. But the reformatory was the best thing I read last year. I love the reformatory. That's a really, I feel like it's a lasting classic. You know, that's one of these books. Yeah. It's one of these books like Ghost Story. You know, people are still going to, you know, decade from now, two decades from now, people are still going to go back to it. It's really scary. It's humane and human. It is a really powerful exploration of a time and a place that is in of itself frightening. You know, set aside the ghost, just the time and place is frightening. And, you know, Stephen was talking about putting words together, you know, that each word is a choice that sort of, you know, flips another switch in the reader's brain. And I think a lot of the work, especially if you write commercial fiction, if you write suspenseful fiction, is to make sure that you've lined up, you know, those words in a way that creates the least friction possible. Mm-hmm. So you're doing as much work, you're carrying most of the weight so that the reader can fly. One of the things that I think is really powerful about the reformatory is that the reader can fly from the first page to the ending. Mm-hmm. And making a book that easy and that much fun is hard, really, really hard.
That's that art conceals art thing.
It was
hard. Exactly.
Oh my God, so hard. It was 7 years of hard. And I tell readers all the time, I read all this research about the real children. It's based at the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, Florida, thinly disguised in a town called Gracetown. But I read all that research. There are things that I read I couldn't even talk about on book tour, you know, like real things that happened to children, because it's like, why do you want people carrying that in your head? So it really moves me so much to hear you say that. First of all, to even mention Ghost Story, because I just wrote a blurb for the Peter Straub Estate, you know, about him and he was so generous and such a wonderful
Peter.
Artist, and so sad he's gone. So yeah, I'm just glad that it resonated with you, that for you to call it fun means everything, because it was not a fun write at all.
I believe it. I 100%.
I kind of feel like you want to carry your own cross. if you're going into an arena that causes you real pain, the point is not to give that pain to the reader. You don't give them enough to cripple them or send them into a place where they need to break rapport with you. You can give them just enough poison to make them dizzy. But it's your responsibility to do that. And I think an awful lot of writers poison themselves trying to process all the pain of the world and find some way to put it into fiction. You know, it's one of the reasons I think that this is, you know, storytellers, you know, this is a holy profession in a real way. Stories give context. How do you have just, you took multi-generational pain in your family, sweetheart, and you turned it into a popular entertainment without losing the integrity. You have not ignored your ancestors.
No, so. I wanted to honor them without all of us drowning, right? In their pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, thank what you.
What about
for
you,
that,
Joe? Do you dig into your personal angsts, your historical angst?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, depends on the story. I mean, I know that, you know, everything you were just saying, you know, really resonated with me. I had when my first novel came out, it was a hit, and you know, it's Heart-Shaped Box, and I, up until that time, I had most of my experience with failure. I had written 4 novels that I was never able to sell. You know, I dozens of short stories. I, you know, collected over 1,000 rejection letters, and I was mentally unprepared for success. And so after Heart-Shaped Box, I did the traditional thing that you do following success, which is I got divorced and had a nervous breakdown. And I couldn't find my way into the second book to save my life. I wrote a piece of this and a piece of that. Everything was terrible. And getting the second book written was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Now, what book was that, Joe?
Horns.
Ah, okay.
And, well, and, you know, there's a thing. Sometimes you'll hear, you know, really pretentious rock stars say, you know, I don't know how people can dance to that song. I was in so much pain when I wrote it. You know, and you're always like, what are you talking about? Actually, I kind of relate. I kind of get it. You know, I'm proud of Horns. And I think that it's a book that, you know, a lot of people have really connected with. Personally, I hate to think about it. You know, I at some point I'm going to have to reread it. I haven't looked at it in years. At some point, you know, I want to go back and reread it. But, you know, but it's like approaching a radioactive object for me. There's a thing in Chernobyl. There's a piece of melted slag called the elephant's foot, which is the most radioactive object on the planet. You know, and I sometimes feel that second novel, Horns, for me is like my personal elephant's foot. I almost don't want to go anywhere near it because it was just, I just dislike everything about who I was when I wrote it.
What was the motivating image or sensation? What made you feel that this was something you had to write? What did it connect to in your experience?
So. I haven't said too much, and I generally don't say too much about everything that was running through my head. But I had a, you know, at the time, but I did have, you know, people suffer much worse. They have much more serious emotional problems. I did have a kind of paranoid nervous breakdown. And you know, my head just whirled with paranoid fantasies. And you know, and that's really what the book is about. You know, the book is about, in the first chapter, you know, this guy goes out at night. He's been blamed for killing his girlfriend. He goes out at night and gets drunk and curses God. And when he wakes up the next morning, he's growing a pair of horns and he's inherited all the powers of the devil. And everyone he encounters feels compelled to tell him their darkest secrets, their worst sins, and then ask permission to do more. And you know, no matter who he goes to, his family, you know, his doctor, his priest, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And that's like what the inside of my head was. So, you know, that first part, the first 70, when I finally latched in, I was like, and it thought, okay, here's my concept. The first 70 pages, actually, that at least wrote pretty quickly and pretty easily. It was the rest of the book that was difficult to do because I couldn't get out of my own way.
Well, let me ask you this, because with the reformatory, for me, it dragged on for years. I would work on anything and everything except that to avoid it. And then COVID hit. And it was the thought, oh my God, I could die before I finished this book. Like 2020, when there was no vaccine, when people were dying, it's like, I even talked to Steve about what to do and what writer he should contact to work with him to finish it. And I put myself on a page quota. Did you have a similar, like, focusing moment when you were working on Horns that got you over the worst of it?
I know that both my dad and I occasionally will send each other drafts of books that are mostly finished before we fly, just in case, you know, the plane doesn't actually land. So I relate to the kind of, okay, you know, if I don't make it, here's what to do with the book.
Yes.
Because that's obviously the most important thing is, you know, never mind that I just died and left.
No, it's all about the book.
You can't do anything about the dead, but we can do something about that dream, you know. That
true.
We all have that sense that, you know, communication, the web of our associations with our families keeps us alive. You know, this is immortality, you know.
And
with art, kind of the same thing, but really what it is that sense of, is there anyone out there who gets me? Is there anyone out there who really has any sense of what's behind my eyes, you know, and what's in my heart? I think that we are so desperate to believe that the people around us, you know, that existential angst thing, that I'm going to go in the ground forever thing.
Yeah.
And
all
might
we
I
keep
say,
is what we give away.
As horror writers, that's always in my head. I think, I don't know about you, but I have a fixation almost with mortality, which is
on your own death, on the subject of your own death. I mean,
the reality of it. Yeah.
I also think getting a story down on the page that, you know, means something to you emotionally and hopefully means something to other people, you know, is in some ways, you know, a lasting sort of thing that you can give to the people in your life.
Yes.
Because I'm not actually that interesting off the page. So, you know, sort of the most interesting thing I could leave the people in my life would be my stories. Because just as a sort of dude away from the keyboard, you know, I don't know, not really, you know, I mean, not really that terribly fascinating. I think people get excited about an author's work and want to meet them. And that can be a fraught proposition and somewhat occasionally disappointing. When I do like events, I'm performing myself. I'm putting on a performance as a kind of more interesting Joe Hill, a funnier, you know, but that's not really who I am at home.
Well, you see, that's perfect. That's perfect. I was a guest of honor at a convention with Nichelle Nichols. And I had a chance to spend some time with her, and she was giving me advice, career advice. And she said, people don't really want to know who you are. They don't know about your weaknesses, your frailties. You create a simplified version of yourself. Yes. It's not a lie, but you let them interact with that simplified version. And you keep the real you for your circle of intimates. But it's not just for your own protection. It's also to give your readers or your fans what they need from you. You know, and God, I thought that was so wise.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree 100%. Yes, absolutely.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% back at hundreds of stores, and it's all happening this week, May 6th to May 13th. It's the perfect time to shop for everything on your list for spring and summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. I know I'm using this week to stock up on some warmer weather essentials at Ray-Ban and Ulta, and I love that Rakuten even helps me save on travel at sites like hotels.com. Rakuten really is the best way to shop, and you can save even more by stacking cash back on top of deals. Plus, during Big Give Week, that cashback is bigger than ever. With Rakuten, membership is free, and when you sign up and shop today, you get an extra 10% cashback boost. That's an extra 10% cashback on top of the 15% cashback. You won't see higher cashback rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You know, one of the things is that, you know, with social media, writers are on the stage all the time now. You know, they're never not at an event. Every time you go on social media, you're back in the bookstore speaking to your audience, speaking to your readership. And I think, you know, that raises some questions about, well, what am I doing when I am on social media? What do I share there and what don't I share there? What am I keeping? What do I need to keep for me?
Right.
So that the work still has, so that, you know, my family still has something, and that my work still has something.
And you still have something.
Yeah, something
for yourself.
Your life
becomes purely performative.
That's why when I go on social media, I mostly just want to talk about horror films.
Yeah.
That, you know, and I have to agree with you on that. I used to, back in the day, use Twitter in a more political way, you know, and like Ferguson and Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
And now, for a variety of reasons, the basic destruction of Twitter by its new owner, the sort of the craziness of the world in general, I've really pulled back on political posts. I mean, a lot. In fact, I would say they're rare at this point, which used to define me on social media. Now it's more, like you said, talking about horror is a safe space because the horror community right now is a beautiful and thriving place. It's my happy place. And humor, you know, just trying to make people laugh.
My wife is always surprised or has expressed, my wife works in publishing. Her professional name is Jillian Redfern, and she is a senior editor at Gallant, which is a big fantasy science fiction imprint in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And she publishes a lot of fantasy and a lot of science fiction, but not a whole lot of horror. And because we've been together, she's really gotten to know the horror community. And one of the things she always says is that everyone in the horror community are like the sweetest, nicest, most inoffensive, friendliest, you know, people. She's that it's been a shock to her at how sunny everyone in the horror community is. And I don't really, she's totally right. I don't exactly know why that is.
Oh, it's because your writing is feeding on your shadow.
Oh, I love that.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. And that makes room for the light. You found your therapy. That you don't, people are often in denial of the darkness within themselves, and then it turns on them and eats them. Whereas the people who go deeply into that are constantly looking at the fear and looking at the pain, whereas most people ignore that and deny that. So in that sense, I think you're completely correct that the more deeply you go into that, it's like you're cleaning out the sewage from your basement.
Yeah,
you're actually turning it into fertilizer.
And
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say. I mean, I've rarely met authors who were a-holes, but in horror, like as I'm thinking of all the names, it's like everyone is so sweet. That's all.
Well, the other thing is I think from the outside, especially people who don't much care for horror fiction or horror films, I think there's a general belief that horror is about sadism, but actually horror is about empathy. Horror is about, in a good horror story, you're introduced to characters you love and identify with and care about, people you're rooting for, and then you see those people facing the absolute worst.
Yes.
So, confronted with some of the most pain and some of the most fear that human beings can. I mean, that's really the reformatory. In a lot of ways, that's really how the reformatory works. And so that's about in that sense, people who are into horror fiction are people who are thinking about compassion. At least that's my operating theory.
I agree. Compassion. And also for me, it's preparation too, because I felt that I had such a gentle childhood compared to my parents, right? The first horror fan in my life was my mom, who was a civil rights activist and wore dark glasses her whole adult life after being tear gassed. And she did carry a lot of trauma in her body. And she loved horror. So it was only after Horror Noir, we did that documentary, A History of Black Horror for Shudder, I started to think about it. I never got to ask her, though, about that direct connection between her trauma and her love for horror. But it definitely does work as sort of a necessary nutrient for me to get past that overactive imagination I have about my own mortality and the temporal nature of our existence.
You can ask questions. Writing is magic. You're putting ink spots on a page and people are feeling something. And that suspension of disbelief thing, you're pulling them in. When it's a horror story, you get to ask the question, why would anybody voluntarily do this? There has to be a part of our minds that says, I don't want to go down that road. So how do you do that? And the very best in the field, what they do is exactly what you said, Joe. They create people.
It's about the people
you love and you care about, and social contexts that you believe in. It's like, oh, I've been in that town. I know these people. And now slowly you begin to integrate, you begin to twist and turn. And if you do it right, if the empathy is created, I mean, we've all had that experience of getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to get a glass of milk and you turn on the television while you drink it and you get sucked into something. Mm-hmm. And you got to know how it ends. And the worse the situation gets, the more the mundane aspect of the story. In other words, like Alien worked partially because they were blue collar guys. These weren't scientists. They were just people. They were talking about, the bonus situation. It was,
yeah.
And because we, I recognize those. Those are Teamsters. I recognize those people. Now the cosmic horror is anchored in the mundane emotions, and the viewer and the reader have no option but to stay on the roller coaster ride with you. What is going to happen?
Tanana Reeve said it's about practice too. I'm friends with that horror is about practice. I'm friends with a horror researcher in Denmark, a Dane named Matthias Claussen, who wrote a book called How Horror Seduces, which I think is the best nonfiction work about the genre in the last 20 years. Mm. Really tremendous read. He tackles horror fiction and horror film from the point of view of evolutionary science. He co-authored a widely quoted study that showed conclusively that horror fans adapted to the pandemic lockdowns better than people who don't like horror.
That was his study.
And no one can be surprised by this. We've all already played out that scenario.
The contagion, captain trips,
what's your plan during the zombie apocalypse? And so when COVID hit and everything changed in 2020 and 2021 and people were stuck at home and they were masking up, if if you were a horror fan to a degree, you've already lived it. Of course, yes. You would emotionally adapt faster than, you know, someone who doesn't watch that kind of thing or read that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've had people, been on panels, people talk about, well, why would anybody read that stuff, watch that stuff? You know, it triggers violence in people and this and this. And I said, you know, I don't know if I'm the only person in this room who's willing to admit that I love this and I think that it is a healthy expression of my stresses. There are times when I just want to sit and watch, you know, like I'm just going to be honest. You know, there is some sort of a thing, let's say it tinges racially, you know, Trayvon, this and the other. There's nothing's going to satisfy except watching Jason kill some white teenagers. Bring it on.
Podcast does not actually condone the killing of white teenagers.
Laugh in the audience.
It's a release.
They think I'm joking. But it's the truth is that there are all sorts of things that I have fears about and concerns about and resentments about. And I don't want that to ever get between me and being able to love the people around me and being able to see the humanity in the people around me. So I do it in my fantasies. I get it all out in my fantasies. You know, it's I think that we all living things try to move away from pain toward pleasure. And we try to do what we can to make it through our lives with a certain degree of integrity. And our entertainments are as important. They're not just frosting on the cake. They're meat and potatoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Agreed.
I'm friends with a fellow named Christopher Golden, who's a great horror writer.
Yes,
and,
of course.
Yeah, Chris is one of the really good guys of the business. And I went to go see – I remember having sort of this kind of personal revelation. I went to go see a not spectacular horror film with him. I can't remember what it was. Maybe it was the sequel to The Ring.
Okay.
Ring 2,
you know?
Something like that.
Yeah, Ring 2. But I remember it has a lot of jump scares in it. And we went to go see it opening night. And the audience was, you know, the theater was packed with teenagers. And I noticed that there'd be a jump scare and everyone would scream, except for me and Chris, who would grab each other and burst into laughter, you know, and we laughed our way through the whole film. And over the years, I've noticed when I go see a scary movie with other horror writers, that happens a lot. There's a lot of laughing.
Yeah. And,
you know, you were saying what you were just saying about, you know, watching Jason Voorhees knock off some teenagers, you know, the slasher films, especially from the 80s. I don't know if they're great horror, but a lot of them are terrific slapstick comedy.
Yes.
Especially if your interior wiring is the interior wiring of someone who loves the genre.
I was the only person in the theater who laughed at the end of The Mist.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. That's
I don't find that funny.
The
cinematic.
It is a little bit, though. It is a little bit because right after he kills everyone, the mist clears up. Like, joke's on you.
That's right. It was the cosmic absurdity of it. It's the thing. You go all the way through yin and you get to yang. All the way to yang, you get to yin.
Yeah.
The point where this is just so much that the only thing we can do is laugh. And I think that screams and laughter are right next to each other neurologically. They're almost the same thing.
I say this all the time. This is like a routine. This is like, you know, right out of my, you know, when I do events and stuff, this comes up all the time. When you watch the Three Stooges and Barry hits Mo with a sledgehammer, you laugh. When you watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Leatherface hits a teenager with a sledgehammer and blood spatters into the camera, you scream. But it's fundamentally the same scene.
That's
you're
right.
Actually watching the same scene, and both is kind of reaching into your amygdala. You know, it's getting deep into your brain and provoking this kind of, you know, reflexive vocalization. And that reflexive vocalization is the scream or the laugh. Go ahead. That's it. That's the whole spiel.
But we had the chance to have a conversation with Jordan Peele about that on not our podcast, but a Black Horror. class, actually sunkenplaceclass.com. It's a digital download course now that I think about it. But when he talked about that relationship between the laugh and the scream, because everybody was so surprised when he came out as a huge horror guy. And no, it's always been there. And it's basically the same misdirection of expectations, he said. So that misdirection of expectations can lead to a laugh or it can lead to a scream. And I wanted to go back to that movie theater with you and Christopher Golden. I wonder if you think there's a generational difference. Like the teenagers are scared. Is it because they haven't been through anything yet? Like they haven't lost a parent. They haven't, you know, they haven't had as much life trauma as you and Christopher had, or
I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit of it. I mean, I do think one famous function of horror films going back to at least the '50s is, you know, for young folks to go to the movie theater together and grab each other in the dark. You know, yeah. And that's like an important kind of, you know, we're going to share this. I don't know. That's a really good question. Maybe, you know, the kids, teenagers, 20 somethings, maybe they like to go to horror films because adult life is scary, but you don't admit it to yourself. And that, you know, a horror film is an opportunity to kind of let it out, to just scream at sort of like, oh my God, I'm an animal on planet Earth and all this terrible stuff is waiting for me. Like someday, you know, I'm going to have a baby or, you know, or whatever, or someday this, right. Or two, you know, someday, you know, who knows? I don't know, you know, but so maybe that's part of the appeal, but also, I mean, it's an adrenaline rush, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, you know, and that feels good. The aftermath of the adrenaline rush feels good.
There is a range within which we can live. And that's true with temperature, with air pressure, and it's true with emotion. And try to keep yourself in the range where you can function. You can get up every day and trade another chunk of your life for the paycheck that keeps the roof over your head. And watching your parents get older, watching your grandparents die, understanding you're on the same damn train.
Yeah.
And what's going on here? I think we're constantly in that. Let me jack up my tension by watching Die Hard. Let me release my tension by watching Blazing Saddles. Let me pretend that I'm addressing death, ha ha ha, by watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Let me get a little closer to something reality with Silence of the Lambs. Let me go all the way into the nightmare and watch Martyrs. You know, that what you can handle, that gives your life meaning or allows you to stay in the temperate zone varies from time to time. You know, sometimes you just need to laugh. And like the Brady Bunch movie was a lifesaver right after the last time I saw my father while he was dying of cancer. I drove home. I stayed in a little hotel in Oregon and I was just, you know, crying in my room. I said, let me get out of my room. And I saw the Brady Bunch movies playing, and I went there and I laughed myself sick and vented that. And a good horror movie would have done the same thing. It would have taken me in and taken me through it.
Steven Soderbergh said a thing once. I love his films. You know, I think he's an amazing filmmaker and an amazing thinker. But he said something once that I really disagreed with, where he said, you know, that art doesn't really basically matter. You know, that it's not really, you know, art never made a difference in anyone's life or something along those lines. And I'm probably mangling the quote, you know, mangling his sentiment. But I think that's, you know, a pretty, you know,
he's wrong.
I think it's a pretty wrong take.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the crazy thing is not only can great art, the right book at the right time, you know, make a huge difference in someone's life. Sometimes a not even very good movie or a not even very good book can be just exactly what you needed. You know, I remember going to see American Pie 2 a few days after 9/11. You know, and it was weird. It was just, all I had thought about was people leaping to their death for 3 days. All I had thought about was, I was just, you know, this unbelievable, you know, horrifying thing that people watch live on TV. And, you know, and it was just like, that movie was, it's not a good film.
It's not a great comedy or anything like that, but it was like a cold washcloth across a fevered forehead.
Yeah.
And actually, I came out of that movie with an idea for a short story that sort of became the pivot point of my whole career professionally. It was sort of like the, you know, I was watching the film and I was looking at these, you know, attractive young people. And I was thinking, in this film, these kids are, you know, in their early 20s, fit, young and sexy, and they're going to be that way in this film forever. But someday they're going to be dead too, like the people in the towers. Someday, you know, sickness is going to come for them. Tragedy is going to come for them, you know. And when they're gone, they'll be ghosts. Every time you watch this film, you'll be watching ghosts on the screen. And wow. I was watching this in this small town, this giant, rotting small town movie theater. And I started to think about, I started to imagine, what if you loved the movie so much that after you died, you kept going, you know, that you just had to get to the new release every week, you know? And I wound up writing a story called 20th Century Ghost about a guy who meets the girl who haunts his small town movie theater and how that changes his life. And that short story sort of opened up, you know, a whole realm of the possibility for me. You know, it was the one of two or three real turning points in my career writing that story.
Beautiful. Ooh,
nice. And I love that it's a short story.
You just gave a real gift to our listeners. What you just said right there over the last 90 seconds, two minutes, is the core of what we try to do on this show, which is take successful artists or artists on the path, you know, of mastery, that thing, and asking, how do you connect with the powerful emotion that drives the work? And then you combine that with the craft so that you are communicating to people so that they are feeling and going through an experience similar to what you felt when you were writing. And it's like, I feel these powerful emotions. I'm going to use my skill and my words, my structure and so forth to communicate it. And then on the other end, I'm praying that there's someone who is enough like me that they will feel these things. So I want to make sure that our listeners, you know, back up and listen to what Joe was just saying about that. This is your path to doing the best work you're capable of doing, is to make sure that you're starting with a powerful emotion.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that you mentioned the short story form. We're always encouraging writers to embrace the short story form for a variety of reasons. And even though they're not short stories, Joe, I have to say I am reading Strange Weather. I'm a little late, but I am reading it because I've read that that's one of your favorite books of your own. And that first one with the teenage protagonist, of course, reminds me of how much I love writing children and teenagers, and how loss of innocence is a theme that I come back to again and again. And you write children so well, and obviously The Black Phone, you have children, Nosferatu focuses on children. Is that something that you return to? Is it loss of innocence or the child mind? What fascinates you about writing children?
Well, instead of answering the question, I'm going to turn it around back on you.
Okay.
Because we were just talking about how comedy and horror are the same thing. But have you ever noticed how close horror and young adult fiction are? That horror is almost like one step to the right of young adult fiction. And why is that? That's so strange. I mean, because The Reformatory features two, you know, young adult protagonists. I think the boy is like 13. And
yeah, he's like 12
or something. Yeah. So they're real young. I've read, there's a horror writer named Scott Carson, actually the pen name for Michael Corita, and he's got a new book out, I think, in March called Lost Man's Lane. You know, it's really scary. It's a great thriller. You know, it's set in like 1999, the year 2000, you know, right sort of as the millennium, as we shifted over into the new millennium. Again, every character in it is like Harry Potter age. They're all teenagers. So many of the horror stories I love, from, you know, Something Wicked This Way Comes to, you know, I don't know, It, you know, it's children, you know, Lock and Key, my comic Lock and Key is all the protagonists are kids.
Another example.
So what is that? Why is why is the, it seems to me that the difference between a young adult novel and many horror novels is, you know, is an R rating.
And not even that sometimes, to be honest, you know, because Steve and I wrote a couple of young adult zombie novels, Devil's Wake and Domino Falls. And while we were researching that, our editor was like, don't be shy about the sex, the drug, none of that. Don't be shy. That's what they're reading. And right? What killed us was that we had to literally cut the book in half, right? Like the book was supposed to be one book, but because young adult books are packaged differently, the length of it meant we literally had to chop it in half.
So it was a duology. It became one book became a duology.
Yeah, that's how it became really a duology. And we talked. I talked to my agent Donald Moss about whether the reformatory should be young adult, like way, way back in the beginning. And his feeling was no. And I didn't quite get all the reasons because it does fulfill the rules. The kids are in charge. The right. kids are what make everything happen. They're not relying on the adults to get them out of the situation. So that right. is all true. But I think it's the length. Some of the language and use of language maybe is a little bit different, but you're right about that. A lot of horror fans love reading and watching kids in peril, not because we hate kids, but I think for me, I remember being that kid. I remember very vividly being that 12-year-old kid, seeing the world through different eyes for the first time. And it's scary, that coming of age awareness, loss of innocence moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I also think that horror, one of the things I love about the genre is that horror is always taken up for vulnerable populations. You know, it's looked at who doesn't have power, who is already at risk, and then it plunges them into horrifying scenarios. Children, of course, have very little power. So, you know, when they begin talking about apparitions, when they begin to think there's a serial killer who's, you know, working a town or whatever, no one believes them. No one listens to them. You know, I was thinking about Stranger Things, which I love. I mean, is Stranger Things a horror show or is it a young adult show? I don't really know. Isn't it kind of both? And
both.
How would you define horror? I'm interested in that.
Horror is what happens. It's what we talked about earlier. It's what happens when people you care about are faced with the worst that humans can face, or even a little beyond, you know, when you're talking. And when I discuss it, when I talk about it in, you know, in the sense of preparation, of rehearsal, in the way that we were talking about it earlier, in the way that Matthias Claussen talks about it, you know, the example I use is vampires aren't real. You're never going to be attacked by a vampire. You're never going to feel your life force draining away night by night as you're preyed upon by an amoral and invisible force that wants to wipe you out. That's never, ever going to happen to you. But some people will get a cancer diagnosis in their life, you know? And then you will find yourself grappling with an opponent you can't see that's making you weaker every day. And I think that we have a need. You know, fiction offers a safe playground of the imagination where you can go and you can try some things out and even have fun doing it without really experiencing it, you know? And maybe you could look at, maybe, you know, you're in the vampire scenario. You're reading the book and you could say, well, I wouldn't want to be like that guy. I wouldn't want to go out, you know,
You touched
so miserably,
right?
You touched on something there that I really want to talk about because it connects to something that Jordan Peele was talking about. That in Get Out, he put a discussion on the screen that I'd never seen anybody put before, the concerning race and fear and wondering who you can trust, so forth. And I think that it became a water cooler conversation because he knew how close he could get to the thing that we're afraid of in this country, that, you know, our original sin in one particular way. He knew how to make you laugh when he needed to release enough tension that you didn't go into that it's only a movie space. If it gets too tense, you do that it's only a movie to release. But if he can make you laugh, it releases enough tension to keep you in the bubble, to keep you in the place where you've got no escape. You have to keep empathizing with what's going on. So humor is one of the great tools to enable you to kind of stay right. You know, I'm going to keep you right where I want you. There is no escape. You don't get to shut down on this. I'll make you laugh, diminish the tension, keep you there.
So a couple things there. One, I saw Get Out opening night, and you want to talk about humor and horror being closely wired together. The main character is walking through a suburb in the first 6 minutes of the film.
Yes.
Black guy walking through really tony suburb, and a cop car rolls up behind him and is just creeping along a few feet behind him. And he says, okay, here we go. And I actually thought that was the scariest part of the film. I thought, oh boy, where is this going in the next couple of minutes? This could get really bad, because we're all running that scenario through right. our head.
There's fear.
But it's also funny, guilt. But I mean, but the theater also laughed. I mean, the theater was yes. like, here we go.
Because he goes, nope.
It takes a world-class comic. I'd never been around a world-class comic in a relaxed situation where he was very clearly capable of making you laugh or think at any moment. At any moment in the conversation, he could turn it into a hysterical joke. And it's, I'd never seen that up close before, you know, in a relaxed way. And to what degree do you think you have used humor to enhance horror?
Well, let me go back to Jordan Peele for a second. Do you remember in Candyman, in the Candyman remake, there's a moment where this woman is looking down in the basement and there's like rusty chains hanging. She's looking for a place to hide. She's worried like the serial killer is going to come back to the shop. She opens the door. She looks down in the basement and it's like dirt floor, and like chains hanging from the ceiling and cobwebs and everywhere. And she stares down, she looks at the doorway, and it holds on her for like 1 second. Then she goes, nope.
Yeah,
and
she grabs the
door. And everyone busted up, because it's like, you know, in any other film, she runs and hides in the basement. And you're thinking, don't go down there. It was just great that it was like, and that's like a classic Jordan. That's like a Jordan Peele.
It is. And then one of his techniques is that he feels like he can keep people in that bubble that Steve was talking about.
If you
acknowledge the reality, like the audience is thinking, don't go down there.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a character who vocalizes what the audience is thinking, you can get away with more.
So part of the game, especially in modern horror, part of the game now is everyone's seen a lot of horror and read a lot of horror. And so you have to try to avoid, you know, egregiously stupid protagonists doing things that people only do in horror movies and you know, horror novels. But on the other hand, you know, people living their lives don't think I'm in a horror movie and actually do make a lot of choices that are sort of, by horror movie logic, not always that great.
Well, but, you can do a fun movie, you know, where it's slightly meta in terms of the people in the movie have seen horror movies. Okay. Then there are other movies where it's just, it might as well be the horror movies don't exist. That people are all the way in there. And we're just on that ride. Like I said, movies like Martyrs, which I think is as close to an unwatchable movie as I've ever seen, that I consider to be a film of value.
Mm. You know,
because I think they had a serious question at the core of that movie. So the horror was in service to the notion we would do anything to find out what happens on the other side of death. I believe that's a reality. Would it have been possible for Jordan Peele to have made that movie funny? Yeah, he could have. There's a funny premise in there someplace. But to the degree that I think yeah, trying to figure out how someplace. Do you make a comedy, a musical comedy out of Martyrs? A musical.
Anyway, but it's so, Joe, yeah, I wanted to ask you, because the focus of our podcast, Life Writing, is really sort of the life and the artist sort of entwined. So how do you strike work, art, life balance? I mean, I hope you don't mind mentioning, I know you have twins.
Yeah, 20-month-old twins. Yeah.
That's a lot. So
Yeah. I mean, I haven't slept in 20 months. I've actually been hallucinating this entire conversation.
Yeah, we're well, not here.
Yeah. Actually, my computer's the funny thing is my computer is actually turned off right now and I'm just speaking through a dark screen and, you know, and
that's hysterical.
It's a tumor. Joke.
Well, post pandemic, you know, my wife was able to move her work at home, and she still, even though things have theoretically gone back to normal, I don't know if that's true, but even though things have theoretically gone back to normal, you know, she still primarily works from home, which has been a huge blessing because her office is in London and I'm in America. So it wouldn't be, I don't know, you know, we'd probably be living over there if she had to be in the office every day, which would be all right. I mean, that would be fine. We would have made that. But so we, you know, we split childcare and work time and make it work, patch it together. And, you know, it's really just us. We don't have, like, you know, anyone to help with the kids or anything, but that's all right. You know, the kids are a blast and a lot of fun, and it's great to discover books with them. And it's funny how, you know, I was talking to her this morning. It's funny how sad it is to be two. I mean, you're always crying. Things are always, you know, and I mean, they're like spring rain showers. It doesn't really have any deep. It's just, you know, it showers and then it stops and then they're back to laughing again and stuff. But isn't it too bad that the first couple of years of our life, we have to spend so much time in tears?
I love the empathy of that observation, because most people are like thinking about it from the other end, like what a pain it is to hear people crying rather than feeling, you know, bad for your kids.
There's an entire psychotherapeutic discipline called core transformation out of Colorado that says that all human behavior, whether it's positive or negative, the worst behavior you can point to or the best, is nothing but an attempt to reconnect with the peace we felt in the womb. That once upon a time.
That's like the kind of thing my mom talks about.
Yeah. You know, and you know, so
my mom is a big believer in that kind of thing. Absolutely.
You could take the most evil person and ask them what the purpose of their action was. And then if your purpose was totally fulfilled, what then? And they will then come to a different quest. Well, if I had all the money I needed, then I'd do this. And if you know, and I'd be able to make friends. And if you had all the friends you needed, then what? Well, I wouldn't feel alone and I'd be able to feel safe. And if you felt totally safe, then what? And you can literally walk them from mugging and killing an old woman down to tears and the sense of, I just want to feel connected to God or my mother's heart or whatever. And that everything we ever do. So when you talk about those two-year-olds, maybe they're still young enough to remember what it was to be totally peaceful, but they're beginning to see that the world is going to do everything in its power to stop you from getting back there.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I do think that there are some people who are fundamentally maybe broken.
It's possible.
You know,
I think there are predators.
Although, you know, Dananna, even in the reformatory, I mean, I can't believe you even found, unless I'm totally crazy, and you can tell me if I'm crazy, I thought there were a couple moments where you even found some empathy for that.
The warden?
The bag of shit who ran the reformatory. I mean, he is the most terrible human. He is a hideous human being. A hideous human being. But I thought there were a couple moments there where, I don't know, there was almost like, you know, there was some trace of humanity there at some point.
Some of that was playing with the reader, Joe. But some of that was also,
He was pretty terrible even as a child. So that's what I'm talking about people being fundamentally broken, though.
Yeah.
I
think you're right. I also think that there is a tiny percentage of people who are pure predators. They literally take pleasure from causing pain. I mean, literally, like watching a cat play with a mouse or a lizard.
Yes.
Don't tell me that instinct isn't there. I mean, and it. I had one veteran. We were talking about war, and I said that at a convention, and the room was packed. And I made the comment that one of the things that veterans can't tell people is that one of the horrors of war is they discover that it feels good to do these terrible things.
So unleash that.
You can't tell anybody that because no one will understand it. You've been forced to discover something about yourself that is totally verboten to feel
it. It feels good that you're alive. He's dead.
That's right. That's right. So that instinct that it literally feels good to do this thing, you discover that. What do you do with that? And I had a veteran who was in the room, standing in the back, listening to all this conversation, come up to me afterwards very quietly and said that I was the only civilian who he'd ever heard speak that truth. And thank you.
Wow.
You know, so I think that that there are people who are broken, and that part of that brokenness can be to go right down to the burning core of what we are, which is totally not politically correct. It has nothing to do with the social rules. It has to do with the animal, the reptile hindbrain.
But you know, back to your point about Warden Haddock and the reformatory Joe, he really is one of those people who, as a kid, learned to connect to that place, that it felt good to hurt.
It's a great name.
I wanted to have a little bit of
Dickensian. I love that Haddock.
That's I appreciate that. He is a whole fish. And he came into the world kind of evil. But at the same time, because one of the monsters in the reformatory is Jim Crow, I wanted to make it clear, you know, some of this was intergenerational trauma for him, too. His grandfather was an overseer. And when you make a living lashing people on trees, you know, or hunting people down and killing them, that's going to trickle into your family culture as well. So,
you know, I'd like to pivot here just a little bit, because we've been talking about reality on one level and we're talking about horror and humor on the other. And if our listeners enjoy the idea of how do you look at the philosophy of this, the psychology of this, how do you manage your skills in your life to produce the best work you're capable of, now, I would strongly, strongly suggest that you take a look at our life writing program. It's a year of discussions like this, of the practical, you know, applications of things, but also the underpinnings that allow you to make your work a joyful thing, a healthy thing, a self-therapeutic thing, at the same time that you're creating the best work you're capable of, because it's nice to be able to pay the bills.
And it is as simple as that. It's weekly digital downloads. So it's kind of like having a coach, you know, like you have a deadlines, you set your own deadlines, but knowing those modules are coming every week, we encourage you to write at least a sentence a day, which is the hallmark of our program. Interviews with writers and screenwriters, and also our own lectures. I've lectured on writing at the Geneva Writers Conference. I taught an MFA program for more than 10 years. Check it out at www.lifewritingpremium.com. Joe Hill, our guest, we would talk to you for like 2.5 hours, but we don't want to take up that much of your day. So how can people find you? I know you have a newsletter. How do they join your newsletter?
Yeah. So I think you can sign up on my website, joehillfiction.com. I'm terrible about keeping the website up to date, but I do a newsletter, you know, once a month or try. You know, I have the two kids. I have twins. I have 20-month-old twins. So, you know, my focus when I sit down to work is to actually get the pages written. Stuff like, you know, promotion or, you know, the newsletter or whatever like that is very, you know, after the fact. So, but joehillfiction.com. I'm on Blue Sky as Joe Hill something, maybe.
If you follow Tanner,
even look under her follows. I'm under there somewhere.
There you go. Probably. Absolutely. Absolutely. Following you from site to site, just so we can keep in touch with each other. He's not yet.
I'm not, but I might as well get on there. There's so many interesting people there. I'm going to be honest with you and say that I have looked forward to this conversation for months, and that you do not disappoint at all.
Oh, that's...
You're so much fun. I'd love. I hope we have a chance to take you to dinner one day and sit down and continue this conversation. I would love that.
Next time I'm out on the West Coast, it'd be great to get together.
Sure. Absolutely. Just give us a call.
Let us know. Take it home. So anyway, everybody, thank you to our guest who's been so great, Joe Hill. You guys, now that you've been so inspired by these stories, why don't you go out and make yourself the hero or heroine in your own story?
The hero in the adventure of your lifetime.
Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.